I'm going to take an even more abstract view of things than was taken in either of the previous two talks, but I just want to say before I start that I actually really believe that the technology that we've been developing over the last couple of years has true application now. The amounts of noise that we have to add for things are very small. It's particularly good technique for what I call the nouveau data riche, the search mining, search engine stuff, and Hotmail user databases of 100 million users and things like that. And these statisticians have been looking at this sort of thing for decades, and I believe that the contributions of this community, the ability to really cleanly articulate what our goals are, what does it mean to lose privacy in a way that really makes sense, and then to make formal claims and be able to prove theorems. And these aren't even conditional theorems, assuming P not equal to NP. These are statistical theorems. Lets us speak clearly and with some authority about the guarantees that we can offer. But I'm really thanking the community for having developed the framework, the methodology, and the way of articulating things. It made a big, big difference here. Okay. I'm going to talk about two kinds of negative results for privacy-preserving data analysis. One of them is that the first definition anyone in this room would try to make about what it means for a statistical database to be privacy-preserving cannot be achieved. I mean, I'll say what that definition is in a minute, but you'll all try, as I did, to start with some notion of semantic security, and it just isn't achievable. And this will actually motivate the definition of differential privacy, which is really what Kobe was talking about with these ratios of probabilities on transcripts distributions. And it's joint work with Morning R. And the second is what will always, I'm sure, be called Dini-style lower bounds on inaccuracy. So there was an absolutely seminal piece of work by Dinora Nisim in 2003, which, roughly speaking, says the following. If you as a privacy mechanism answer too many questions too accurately, and I'll fill in, of course, what I mean by those, then there is no hope of privacy, just absolutely none. And so I'll call this an overly accurate statistical database. It answers too many questions too nicely. And what the second result is an extension of these attacks against overly accurate statistical databases to cope with the case where the statistical database frequently just lies through its teeth, just doesn't tell you anything related to the truth, and still you can compensate. And actually, this is part of a collection of results that extend the Dinora Nisim result, and that collection is joint work with Frank McSherry, Kunal Talwar, and Sergey Gahanin. And at the end, I hope to at least briefly mention some of those results. Now, you've seen a lot of discussion about the non-interactive and the interactive models. For the most part, everything I'm going to say actually applies to both models. Sometimes it's a little bit easier for me to talk in terms of the non-interactive case. Sometimes it's easier for me to talk in terms of the interactive case, but everything I'm saying really applies to both. Okay. So let's start with the first result, the one that says that semantic security can't be achieved. So I said the statisticians have been looking at this for a large number of years. In particular, there's a famous paper by Delenius talking about what should be the goals of a statistical database. And he says that anything that can be learned about a respondent, that is somebody who responds to your survey, from the statistical database can also be learned without access to the statistical database. So in particular, I could be an extrovert, I could publish all of my personal information on the web. Sure, it's possible to do lots of privacy violations, but any statistical database that I'm part of has absolutely nothing to do with that. So you can't punish the privacy-preserving them for the fact that my privacy is violated. I did that myself. It says essentially that the database doesn't leak personal information. And of course, this is exactly analogous to semantic security, with the statistical database sort of playing the role of the ciphertext, and the information about the respondent playing the role of the plaintext. Okay, so this is just a recap of what Delaney has said. More formally, this is the formal version that I want to work with. I want to say that for all distributions on databases, we have to have distributions on databases. If there's only one database in the world, there's nothing to say. So for all distributions on databases, for all adversaries who will interact or see the results from a privacy mechanism, remember it works both for the interactive and non-interactive case, there is an adversary simulator, A prime, so that with high probability, when I choose a database, DB, from my distribution, no matter what auxiliary information is available both to the adversary and the adversary simulator, the probability that the adversary who has access to the auxiliary information and sees or interacts with the statistical database will win, whatever winning means, whatever your notion of violating privacy is, that probability should be close to the probability that the simulator, seeing only the auxiliary information but having no access to the statistical database in any form, will win. We want these two probabilities to be close. Seeing the ciphertext doesn't really help you to learn anything about the plain text, okay? And I'm not going to define small. I'm going to show you that, in fact, this gap is going to be big, and so we don't really care. Now, I'm going to give an example which is informal, extremely. It completely captures the intuition of the proof. So if going through the proof, you understand absolutely nothing. If you remember the example, then you know what's going on. So the example is the following. Suppose we have a database of basic information about people, which includes heights. Now, we all probably agree that things like the average height of American women is this, and the average height of men is that, and so on and so forth, that this should all be privacy preserving. And now suppose I give the auxiliary information that Terry Gross is 2 inches shorter than average. Now, the adversary who gets to interact with the statistical database will learn average heights. And the adversary simulator will not learn average heights. So the adversary knows to very great approximation Terry Gross's height, whereas the adversary simulator won't learn her height. Okay, so there's the difference. Now, this impossibility result required that the database be useful. I could have a statistical database that is empty or random and has no connection whatsoever to anything. And then this example would break. Yes, Dash.
Sorry. The probability goes over the choice of the database in D, right?
The choice of the database and the choices of all the players in the game.
Right. But the auxiliary information is fixed. It's fixed after D is fixed.
Well, there's a universal quantifier on auxiliary information.
But then the statement Terry Gross is 2 inches shorter than average sometimes is true for some choice of D and sometimes no.
The auxiliary information generator in the formal model will have access to the database for the purposes of generating auxiliary information. So that will be fine.
So Z is generated after DB is chosen in D?
Yes, in this case.
But then isn't it really hard that this cannot hold because in particular Z could be just DB?
No, because then they would both have it. Both the simulator and the adversary would have it. And then the gap would be tiny. It would be zero. Okay. So the point is, as I said, that the example requires that the database be useful. And moreover, that this utility of the database, this thing, I mean, why do we have these databases? We have these databases because we think it is of social value to learn trends in the population. right? So that means something is being learned. That means that something somehow is not predictable by someone who doesn't have access to that to the database. And so what we're going to have then, because this utility, whatever it isn't predictable, isn't known to the adversary simulator, is that the hint generator, who will see the database, and the adversary A will share a secret, that is, the utility that's gotten from having information, the access to the database. They share a secret, this secret is unknown to the simulator, and you guys know that this is a powerful situation, that you can use it as a one-time cap. Now, an interesting thing about this attack is that it works even though Terry Gross doesn't have to be in the database. That is, at least intuitively, it will work whether she's in the database or not. And this motivated the definition of differential privacy, which is that what we do is we look at the sort of the ratio of the risk to Terry if she's in the database versus her risk if she's not in the database. What you can do, we want to show that this ratio is very close to one. That's the definition that Kobe gave. Think of this, since we are thinking in a social context, think of this as persuading Terry to go ahead and join the database, because not much is going to happen to her because she's in it that wouldn't happen to her if she weren't in it. So again, this is differential privacy, and this is more like the semantic security. This is the risk to Terry when the adversary does or does not have access to the database. And this is what we're saying, don't do it this way. We're saying do it that way. All right. Now, that's the high-level view of the first result. I'll go back and say more about it. But I want also to give you the high-level view for the other body of work. What time do I end, by the way?
12. According to what day?
Here, this is my watch. What time? I can't see the clock.
Wait, you still have, 35 minutes.
Fine. Okay, so I'm really tired, but the arithmetic tells me that's 12:25. Okay. So, all right, so Dinor and Nissim considered a really simple model, and because you guys are theoreticians, I'm not going to justify the model, but in fact their model, although it sounds terribly simplistic, actually captures some very interesting real-life scenarios, and I can talk to you about those offline. So it's not a simple or toy model, even though it sounds simple. In the simple model, the database is an n-bit vector, call it x here, and the query is an n-bit vector or matrix, you know, horizontal vector, A. And I'm going to call the true answer to the query the real-valued inner product A times A dot x. So in other words, A selects a subset of the rows in the database, and the answer tells you how many of those selected entries are one. So it's a counting query, a sum query. And so I'm using this word for the true answer, to mean the actual value, and the response is the actual value plus some noise. And you saw the distributions on noise. Now, Dinor and Nissim did not define privacy. What they defined is what, I don't know what you guys call it, but I call it blatant non-privacy. So blatant non-privacy is that the adversary, after interacting with the mechanism, asking these sum queries for a while, the adversary can guess all but little o of n entries in the database. So the adversary can write down a candidate database that's almost exactly the real database. It won't know where it agrees and disagrees, especially if it's binary, they could just flip in that case. But still, this is an incredibly strong violation of anything that could be called privacy. So I call it blatant non-privacy.
So these are actual bits.
These are actual bits. It writes down a candidate database that agrees with the real one almost everywhere. The first theorem said that if the adversary just asks all the possible subset questions, and if all of the responses, remember response is true answer plus noise, if all of the responses are within little o of n of the true answer, then the algorithm is blatantly non-private. By the way, since everything that we've been doing, with the one exception of the Eurocrypt paper, which was an implementation paper, since everything that we've been doing is all in terms of statistical notions of closeness, we haven't paid any attention to the computational power of the adversary. So, you know, this is very interesting already for us. But Kolbe and Yerik did pay attention to the computational power of the adversary, and they showed a different kind of result, which says that if all of the responses, are within little o square root of m of the true answer, then the algorithm is still blatantly non-private, but this time even against a polynomial time-bounded adversary that makes only, I'm sorry about this, I meant to fix this line break, only n log squared n randomly chosen subsets on queries. So it's not asking very many questions, it's not thinking at all about how to pose its questions, and then what it does is it sits down and it solves a linear program and it does some rounding and that's what it outputs. Okay, so they introduce linear programming as well for this, for the purpose of attack. Now, this was a really, really important result. Historically, it inspired the line of research that ends up connecting the amount of noise that's added to the sensitivity, which is what Kolbe was talking about in his first talk. And there are many, many positive results in that, that have followed from that. Again, Kolbe mentioned some of those. It's also very crucial in arguing that privacy has a price. That is, it shows that there's no way to avoid increasing the amount of noise as you permit more queries to be asked. And this is very important because you talk to people who are building databases and they say, we're building this great big database and it's expensive and you're telling me that after a while I have to really, really degrade my responses? And the answer is yes. You cannot argue with the math. This is it. Also, even though it's posed in the interactive setting, even though the results were obtained in the interactive setting, they say a lot about the non-interactive setting. And if you talk to, research statisticians say, please just give me a noisy table that lets me compute what I want to compute reasonably accurately. Okay. Can't you please just give me a noisy table to work with? And the answer is no, we can't. Because if I gave you a noisy table that gave you really good answers to everything, then you could carry out a Dean-Ornisian style attack against that table. Make a question, ask it, get an answer. Make a question, figure out the answer, write it down, and so on and so forth, and then analyze the results. So it says a lot, but it doesn't say everything. What if in this noisy table, most of the answers are good, but some of them are terrible? What about then? What if 1 in 10 of the answers is terrible? What if 1 in 3 of the answers is terrible? Okay.
By terrible, you mean?
No relation to reality. Just horribly, horribly bad estimates. Okay. How about then? Can you give me a noisy table that has this just weak properties, and maybe it'll have the answers to what I'm looking for? And the answer again is going to be no. And so, that's. That's a result that I hope to say something about, if I have time. So the outline of the rest of the talk is, I'll go over some details in the proof of that we can't achieve Delenius's goal. I'm going to describe a particular strong Dini-style attack, which, until I run out of time, at least I want to give you the statement of the result and say something, because we use linear programming and decoding, say something about how that fits into the framework of other people's work on linear programming decoding. And I must say, I knew nothing about LP decoding before this work. And to a great extent, this part of explaining the connection to other people's work is definitely work in progress for me. So maybe I'll have help from the audience, I don't know. But anyway, I won't have time, but I have prepared high-level outline of the proof and some details and slides on them. People can talk to me about that later. And finally, I will get to, because I will be warned when I'm running out of time, some of the additional attacks in this body of Dini-style attacks. Okay, so recall our goal was to prove impossibility of satisfying the semantic security-like definition of privacy. So again, I'll just say it, for all distributions on databases, for every adversary that gets to interact with the database or see the sanitization, if that's what's produced, there is an adversary simulator who doesn't get to do that, so that with high probability over the database drawn from the distribution, for all auxiliary information Z, this difference, the probability that the adversary wins versus the probability that the simulator wins, is small. And I want to show that's impossible, so I want to show the difference is big. I'm not going to define win. I don't have to define win, it turns out. Fix any notion that you have of privacy compromise that can be sort of checked by a Turing machine in the following sense. We're going to give to this machine database, description of the distribution from which the database is drawn. Whatever it is that the adversary produces, which is just a string, and I'll call it Q. And this Turing machine is just going to say yes or no. The adversary won or it didn't win. Okay. So I've just totally abstracted away the notion of winning, of violating privacy. I already mentioned that there's a distribution on databases. We have to have some kind of entropy in this distribution. Something about the databases has to be unknown in order, first of all, for the whole thing to be interesting, and secondly, for the proof to work. And we can think of the description of the database, the distribution on databases maybe captures some information about the domain. And this is just sort of a gut feeling stuff. You can ignore this bullet if you want. But for example, it may be that you know that these are databases that are where every row in the database is the medical record of somebody who has at least two pets. Just stuff like that. I don't quite want to think of it as auxiliary information. I think of auxiliary information as more pointed and relying perhaps on the particular database involved. Then we have the privacy mechanism, which can be interactive or non-interactive. I don't care. It takes as inputs the distribution on databases and the actual database. The auxiliary information generator, who also gets both the distribution and the actual database. And this will formalize partial knowledge about a given database. And we have to have some way of formalizing utility. As I said, the impossibility result doesn't work if the database doesn't have to produce something that can be learned. There has to be some point in it. So for us, we capture this by a utility vector, we call it W. And think of it as maybe answers to some number K of questions about the database. This is not a rigorous statement, but it's a nice, helpful image to have in mind. It is a vector of things. And we're not even going to require for utility that it's always the case that the entire utility vector be learned, but most of it should be learnable. And the utility vector also has to inherit some entropy from the source on databases. Again, if there's simply one thing to be learned for all databases, the same thing to be learned for all databases, it's not an interesting thing. So the theorem says exactly what I said it was going to be. Fix any privacy mechanism and privacy compromise decider Turing machine C. Then there's an auxiliary information generator, AuxGen, and an adversary A, so that this gap is always big. All right, fine. And the probability spaces are over the choice of database and everybody's coin flips. Now, suppose that the utility vector is learned completely. This is the easy case. The utility vector in the example is the average heights of women. Okay, the auxiliary information Z is that Terry Gross is 2 inches shorter than average. The privacy violation Y will be Terry Gross's height. So we're comparing two worlds, okay? This is, forget about this side of the slide, which is almost the same. In this world, we have all the players that you've seen We have the database, which is fed into the sanitizer, and it produces a utility vector W. And the adversary A can learn all of the utility vector. We have the hint that's generated by the auxiliary generator, this hint Z, I'm sorry, auxiliary information Z, generated by this guy who has access to the database. We have the decider who says whether what the adversary produces, given the particular database, is a win or not. Did the adversary violate privacy? The hint is going to be the following. We're going to use a strong extractor. So the hint will have two pieces, it will or the auxiliary information, a random seed S, and the result of a random string that's extracted by a from W. Remember I said that the distribution on utility vectors has to have enough min entropy. So there has to be stuff that you can extract. So you extract some, call that an exclusive OR that with the privacy violation, and that's what gets sent. Okay? Now, obviously, the adversary who gets W and who gets the seed S can do the extraction herself and get her hands on the privacy violation. Terry Gross's hype. Over here, the picture is very similar, but the simulator doesn't get access to the sanitizer and therefore doesn't learn W. In fact, learns nothing. Just get Z. All right, so again, the auxiliary information generator can compute W and uses it in generating this thing. And A has W, so these guys share the secret, which is W.
That's interesting. What do you assume about C? Because, I mean, if C outputs 0, it's impossible. So what do you assume about this privacy violator? So what is your assumption about C?
C is a Turing machine that says, it captures your notion of winning.
And so what prevents it to be zero and then your impossibility, like all the time? So there is some non-triviality requirements. I'm just trying to see. There's blatant non-privacy or whatever.
You're right, right, right. So...
That's what I mean.
No. It's a fine question. So we're not going to have trivial ones. That's all.
But you need to be able to find... Oh, you don't have...
No, I don't have to worry about that. So sorry. Again, it just has to not be trivial. Okay. And there are some technical conditions that say that there has to be enough min entropy in the source W, that is the source of these guys, so that even conditioned on Y, there's enough randomness out to get a one-time pad that's good enough to hide Y. And also we need to assume that knowing the length of the privacy violation doesn't automatically give away the privacy violation. So this is worked into the definition. Yes?
What's wrong with the simulator that works by sampling from the database?
Has no database.
Oh, no, sorry. Sampling from the distribution.
What is a distribution on databases? You're saying that the adversary simulator could go out, learn average heights, and do it herself. You've defeated the example, but not the theorem. Okay? You've done this extra step, which is build another database, get all the information that was available to somebody else. But we're interested in cases where our adversary doesn't have information, doesn't have ways of getting that kind of information. Our adversary is me, and the data is somebody's, is medical data, and I just can't go and get people's medical data. Okay?
But you know, if you did, this is the Terry Gross thing is with respect to the database, right? Mm. Not to a randomly drawn database.
But the Terry.
I mean, first was randomly.
What Hotek is sort of actually.
Hotek saying that it's not a utility.
No. Remember, I said that the utility has to have some kind of min entropy. So in your example, the utilities have no min entropy because we learn these things by building more databases. So there, and it's always the same from one to the next. And so you're saying that there's only one utility, and it's learned no matter what your database is. And that's exactly ruled out by saying that there has to be entropy there. Yeah, thanks. Okay. Now, as it turns out, I mentioned that was the easy case, and we might consider a situation in which the utility vector is not going to be learned completely, but only most of it will be learned. So we want maybe some kind of relaxed notion where something close to the utility vector is learned. And by close, I have in mind Hamming distance, because that's what I mean. So the wrinkle that's added technically is that the auxiliary information generator, will not know precisely what it is that the adversary is going to learn. So it doesn't know precisely what random bits the adversary might extract from this object. And they don't have exactly the same W, so they can't extract exactly the same things. We need something that if the adversary has some W star that's close enough to W, it will be able to produce the same extracted randomness of W. Extractors don't offer this, but Dodi's Grazin and Smith do. Okay, so they offer something called fuzzy extractors. Fuzzy extractors are specified by, I guess, a message distribution or a distribution M, a length, that is a length on the an amount of randomness that you extract, a tolerance T, and a closeness measure epsilon. And this is a pair of procedures, a generate procedure and a reconstruct procedure. And when we run the generator procedure, we're going to produce two things, an extracted random string and something called a public string. And the public string is going to be used to help reconcile different different things that are extracted from W and something close to W. I didn't say that right. Wait a second. The guarantee is that for any distribution, capital W, that has enough min entropy, the distribution on random strings and public strings P will satisfy this, that the RP distribution and the ULP distribution, uniform on length L, are within statistical distance epsilon. So in particular, within statistical distance epsilon. So even if you know P, you don't know anything about R. Now, the reconstruction will allow reconstruction given, and the reconstruction of the extracted string R given the public string and any W star that's close enough to W. And close enough is measured by this tolerance parameter T. Okay? And this is exactly what we need. So this is just the same definition, no changes. The idea is going to be that instead of extracting stuff, just plain extracting from W, we're going to extract from W, but we're also going to produce this public string P. We're going to set Z to be P, and again, the randomness stored with the privacy violation. The adversary will be able to reconstruct from its view W star, which is going to be close enough to W. And again, the adversary simulator learns nothing because the randomness looks almost uniform, even though it sees P as part of the auxiliary information. Okay? That's this guarantee up here. Now, this almost works, but there's a small problem. The small problem is that P may say a lot about W. P could be all of W, I don't know. And the whole point is, the reason we're looking at the case that not all of W is learned completely is that maybe it wasn't quite safe to release all of W. So you can only release, or you can only allow people to learn something close to W. But still, it's going to be safe to learn something close to W. And that's kind of the key to this. Instead of working with W itself, the auxiliary information generator will kind of learn a close, what did I call it, W prime that's close to W, and W prime is close to W, and W is close to W star, so W prime is close to W star, and we can still use the fuzzy extractors. So, that's that proof. Here you have exactly the same proof in pictures, but it's really the same thing, and I'm going to go on. So we're going to change topics now. We're going to go to the Dini style result. Sorry, I had some other technical conditions. Fine. So now, talk about this. Remember, we have to warn you.
2 minutes, I will warn you that you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. Okay. So remember the Dini. The Dini setup, the framework for the Dini style and possibility or possibility bounds. So we have a query vector A, we have a data vector V, X, I'm sorry. The true answer is the inner product of A and X, and we add noise, and that's the response that's produced. Now, you could also imagine, if we ask many queries, then we have a query matrix. So you can think of this. For this part of the talk, you can think of a query matrix which has some number m of rows. And everything is as before. The true answer is this product, real valued product, and actually in Rm. And then we add a noise vector to that. Okay? So in this slide, I'm going to tell you what it is we have accomplished. So if we had to stop at the end of this slide, we would at least know what this result was about. E is the error vector. Suppose that the error vector is small on most of the entries, a 1 minus rho fraction of the entries. Now, by small, I will certainly capture the de Nornissim case where I have a bound of little o of root n on the noise, but what I'm saying isn't specific to little o of root n. It's a slightly more general statement, which they could also have done. So in their case, rho is zero, and the error is small on all of the entries.
Error meaning each entry in the
yes,
one.
Each I has magnitude bounded by alpha. And so for them, this is for all I. For us, we don't make it for all I. We allow that on a rho fraction of the I, no guarantee is made whatsoever. So it's an unbounded error on a rho fraction of the entries. Okay? And our query matrix, in their case, they had n log squared n. Our query matrix is going to have some linear in n number of rows, order n rows.
And what did you say they have?
N log squared n. Okay, so we have a slightly better number of rows. Then what we can do is we can reconstruct n minus at most alpha squared entries of x. Alpha squared, alpha is the bound on the noise. So for example, if alpha is little o of root n, then alpha squared is little o of n, and we have blatant non-privacy.
What is rho?
I will get to there immediately. Let me mention some things about previous work not from our community. And this is the part that for me is still very much under reconstruction. I mean, under construction. Work in progress. So there are a couple of papers by Dave Donahoe. There's a paper by Candace or Fields, Metal, Winner, Tal, and Romberg, and there's another paper by Candace, Tal, Rudelson, and Verscheinen. This one was actually in Fox 2005. They looked at a similar problem. They only considered the case that alpha is zero. So in other words, for them, there is some row fraction of the rows which have wild error, but everything else has zero error, much like in the case of error-correcting codes. And for them, they get exact reconstruction, but alpha has to be zero. We also get exact reconstruction when alpha is zero, but we have this more general statement. They get a very small value of rho, which is bad. For example, this paper has a rho that looks something like that. Donahoe has a rho that looks something like that. We get, and I have the expression in some email from Kunal, who ran the program, we get a row that looks something like this, and it's tight. You have any higher fraction of errors, wild errors, then your adversary is defeated, or your decoder is defeated. Okay. Now they get.
Is it tight when alpha equals zero?
For us, no.
So shouldn't it depend on alpha? What the tight is?
No. it's alpha doesn't play a role in the proof, except in the quality of this statement. Okay, it really does nothing. Okay, or very little, as it turns out. They get very small values of n, which is excellent. For example, they get n to be 1 plus epsilon times n in a paper by Donahoe, or n to be 4n in the Fox paper. So they're definitely ahead there. We need m to be something like 500 times n or 1,000 times n. I don't know. But, so, no, they're sort of saying if the errors are very rare, then we don't need so many samples as a function of n to do the reconstruction. We say if the errors are as popular as conceivable, then we need about 500 or 250 times what they need, many samples. For the really adverse, for the setting where the sanitizer is really trying to protect the data, our adversary model makes more sense. Also, there seems to be, and I'm still in the process of understanding this, for them, the support vector of the large errors, the support of their large error vector is independent of the queries. I don't know whether that their proof is robust to handling all possible, what we would call adversarially placed noise. We handle adversarially placed.
What is the original motivation of these words?
Compressed sensing is the original motivation, as far as I know. That's what seems to be mentioned in the papers.
It was actually done here 2 years ago at ITAR, this work of Rubano and Edith.
Mm-hmm.
So that's funny.
Yeah, I should have invited them. Finally, there was result on LP decoding to zero. I mean, help me, Tom. There were results in our community. Feldman and you wrote. Who was the first paper? Was Feldman and whom?
And Carver.
And Carver, right? And then Tal got involved in this, and so on. I'm sorry. I told you we needed to talk, and we didn't get to it. And as I said, I apologize. I don't yet know the. This is very new. I don't yet know the literature, and I can't explain the connection. Okay. So I probably have at least 5 minutes left, so I'll tell you the LP. I phrased it in computer science language. I rephrased it at Betty's request. So it looks like this. The reconstructor is given the response, which is the true answer plus noise, y prime. And of course, it knows the query matrix because it generated them. And its goal is to find an x star. It's going to find an x star such that x star is reals between 0 and 1. And y is equal to x star. And this y is ax star. Y minus y prime in the L1 norm is minimized. Now, I'm not done yet, but starting with this, if there are no small errors, then this will reconstruct perfectly. Okay, the only answer that will come out of this is going to be our real input vector, our binary input vector x. Okay. However, we do want to handle both large wild errors and the small alpha bounded errors, so I call those mixed errors. So in that case, we have to add an extra step, which is a rounding step, which is the obvious rounding step. Now,
sorry, could you just A? Is A adversarial, or you can choose some good error correcting code, or?
Think about A this way. A is going to be remember, I'm interested in the adversary who doesn't even think hard about what questions to ask. So the adversary in this statement of the result is the entries of A are standard normals. We do have a plus minus one version of that. I'll say something about it later. Okay? So it's just not particularly adversarially designed at all. The key lemma, I just want to tell you about this because the key lemma strips out everything that we're trying to do and looks at a different question. So, but to motivate it a little bit, let me try to say this. Remember that we have y prime is equal to ax plus a, and the support of the big errors in E is of size rho m. Think about the small errors now as just not existing, alpha is zero. So we argue that if LP decoding fails, meaning that reconstructin reconstructs to some other z that isn't our input x, then there, it fails means there is a z and there is an error vector that has this property, so that this difference is smaller than this one. Okay, we're minimizing L1 error, this minimized, and the real answer didn't. Some manipulation ends up showing that if we look at, okay, this matrix, A times the real answer minus the one that the reconstruction gave you, that's just a vector, right? It has terms in it, they have magnitudes. It says that there are some rho m of them whose magnitudes beat the sum of the magnitudes of the remaining 1 minus rho m. Okay, so the top heaviest rho m terms outweigh the remaining terms. But AW, where W is just this difference, this is just going to be a vector of normals because A is a vector, is a matrix of normals. And so once we have that W is not zero, we just can ignore W. We just have a vector of normals. We think of W as kind of giving coefficients to so that we're summing up a bunch of weighted normals and we get another normal. Yes. Normal distribution, variables chosen from normal distribution, and they all have mean zero in this case. Okay. So now we can forget about everything and think about a bunch of normals. So we're going to sample now, let's say from the standard normal distribution, some number m of times. The key lemma says that there's a critical threshold, call it rho star, so that if rho is strictly less than rho star, then if we look at the, well, that this doesn't, then with high probability over the query matrix, I'm sorry, with high probability over the sampling here, no rho m of these together have more mass than the remaining rho, 1 minus rho times m. So in other words, this condition just can't happen if rho is less than that critical threshold rho star. So, do I have 2, 3, or 0?
2 and 3 are identical.
Okay, I'm gonna skip to here. Because I want just to, that's all I'm gonna say about that, but feel free to ask me later. I just want to mention some of the other results we have of this style. First of all, as I answered Yevgeny, we have plus minus one version of the LP decoding intact. So instead of A being a matrix of normals, it's a matrix of randomly chosen plus minus ones. We have 1.5 proofs of this. That is, we have one proof which uses a coupling argument, and we believe we know how to make a different proof that in some ways will be nicer. So, but I'm not positive about that. Another thing is that it's possible using huge numbers of questions, or a polynomial number of questions, and epsilon is a constant, it's possible to correct a 1/2 minus epsilon fraction of the errors, you know, wild errors, if you get to ask enough questions and you get to think hard enough about the answers. It's also possible to correct a 1 minus epsilon fraction of wild errors. Again, though, you have to think for a long time, and you don't really do it the way you want, you do it in the list decoding sense. But it's still just an interesting observation. We also have, thanks to Sergei, a deterministic version of the Dini, original Dini results. So this is the case where there are no wild errors. Alpha is little o of square root, well, alpha is just alpha, which is at most, to be interesting, little o of square root of n. And we ask n specific fixed queries, and there's no wild noise. And he uses Fourier analysis, so the queries are the Fourier basis, and there's no LP to solve. So it asks fewer questions, is deterministic, and the computation is easy. We also know that there's no small, in the case where there's no small noise, so alpha is zero, we can use algebraic geometry codes, and we can correct a half minus epsilon fraction of the errors when epsilon's a constant. And what will happen is that the alphabet size will have to grow as epsilon goes to zero. So, but the questions will be integers between minus some constant c that depends on epsilon and plus c. In the non-interactive case, remember I said that DD was interesting because it has applications also to the non-interactive case. So in the non-interactive case, we can correct, at least for a constant epsilon, a half minus epsilon fraction of errors, a fixed epsilon. But again, this is in the list decoding sense. But you don't have to think a lot, and you don't have to ask a lot of questions. I'm sorry, I forget. The number of questions, I guess, should be